Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms, so we do cover quite a wide range of stuff every week. Got Julian Paul here live in the studio as usual. We're on Paternoster Row in the workstation in Sheffield, if you know where that is. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to our PG.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Dr. Ogur Osmal cannot be with us today. He's usually our regular speaker every second Saturday of the month. His background's chemistry and air quality, so he's usually covering air pollution and similar things like that, all good stuff. All being well, next Saturday, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, our guest speaker will be Gareth Morgan, who's member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. And if you live in Sheffield and you get the Yorkshire Post, I think there was an article about Sheffield Photographic Society in there. Or it might have been the Telegraph, I can't quite remember, but all good stuff. Lots to cover today. First up, a very interesting advert I've seen recently around and about. I thought it was very interesting. If you check out www.smartphonefreechildhood.org, it'll tell you all about it. It says smartphones weren't designed with kids in mind, but they've reshaped childhood almost overnight. In the UK, 89% of 12-year-olds now own a smartphone, and so do a quarter of children aged 5 to 7. On average, kids get their first smartphone aged 9. So instead of growing up slowly, children are being pulled into a digital world built to keep them hooked. To be fair, the same goes for adults, if you ask me, but the impact on children's development, their mental health and relationship runs deep. You can sign the Parent Pact online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. So that's at www.smartphonefreechildhood.org. Mm. Interestingly, I think New Zealand, is that correct, have just brought in a ban
on social media.
So I think this is the way the world is going. And as I said, I think some adults have issues, similar issues with smartphone addiction to smartphones. And we can't forget next up the winter solstice. Oh my word! It will be upon us next Sunday, the 21st of December. If you listen on catch up, it is Saturday, the 13th of December, 2025. So the winter solstice, what's that all about then? Well, our Earth rotates on its axis once each day, producing the cycle of day and night. At the same time, the Earth moves around the Sun on its orbit over the course of a year. However, the axis of rotation of the Earth is not lined up with the axis of motion around the Sun. My word, I sound like Phil Muffett. Phil Muffett is our regular guest speaker on the first Saturday and any fifth Saturdays of the month, and he's a member of the Mexborough and Swinton Astronomical Society, who do some amazing stuff. But he's not with us this week. He was with us last week and I think the week before. So I'm just picking up on the winter solstice. So instead of so the axis of the motion of the Sun and the axis of the rotation of the Earth are not lined up together. Instead, the Earth is tilted slightly at 23.44 degrees. This tilt means that during one half of the year, the north side of the Earth is slightly tilted towards the Sun, and the south is tilted away. For the other half of the year, the reverse is true. So the summer solstice occurs when one of the Earth's poles, which is either north or south, has its maximum tilt towards the Sun. It happens twice yearly, once in each hemisphere. That's the northern and southern. The summer solstice happens during that hemisphere's summer. At the exact moment that the northern hemisphere is most tilted towards the Sun, the northern hemisphere experiences its summer solstice. The southern hemisphere, by contrast, has its winter solstice. So the summer solstice, as you might remember, is the day with the longest period of daylight and the shortest night of the year. Whereas the winter solstice is the day with the shortest period of daylight and the longest night of the year. At either of the north or south poles, there is continuous daylight at the time of its summer solstice, and the opposite occurs at the winter solstice, when there is continuous darkness at either pole. So in the northern hemisphere, that's us, the summer solstice was the June solstice, which was the 21st of June this year. And the winter solstice is coming fast upon us. And it's the December solstice, and it's next Sunday, the 21st of December.
Yeah.
melting away this rage. I see you drift through the realm of darkness into light. There's no other way. No explanation, there's no higher station. Nothing will last. You spoke to me. You woke me up. You woke me with a solstice kiss.
Lovely track there by Simple Minds, no less. Solstice Kiss from 2022. We played that because we're talking about the winter solstice, which is for us in the Northern Hemisphere next Sunday, the 21st of December. And it's the shortest period of daylight, boo, and the longest night, but then it's all going the other way. Of course, you listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Next up, a bit of a roundup of some interesting stuff in the news this week, the science news.
Yes, I've got some complicated words to say here.
Oh, dear, Paul, I'll help you.
A new research study has found that the drug cocaine is widely present in the water of some of Northern Ireland's major lakes and rivers. Scientists found the Class A drug and its byproduct in 91% of almost 140 water samples collected in different locations from five waterways: the River Largan, River Bush, Dundrum, Lough Nee and Lough Erne. Ketamine and amphetamine, two Class B drugs that are also used as pharmaceuticals, were also found in the water samples, as well as painkillers and antidepressants. The research conducted by the Agri-Food and Bioscience Institute, AFBI, in collection with Imperial College London, focused on raw water in rivers and lakes, not drinking water that comes from our taps. While there is no risk to human or pet health from interacting with the water, the study does raise concerns for ecosystem health and reflects the extent of drug use in Northern Ireland.
It's a very interesting one because during COVID, if you remember, they were testing water samples throughout the UK, looking for signs of where the infections were most concentrated. And part of that, they were finding that there's a lot of drug use in Manchester, Birmingham, big cities. Incredible what you can tell from testing water in the sewage system, eh? Anyway, on a happier note, the range of red squirrels in the Highlands has expanded by more than 25% in a decade, thanks to a rewilding initiative run by the charity Trees for Life. Surveys show that more than a dozen new populations of red squirrels are breeding successfully as far north as Ullapool, with many spreading and creating interconnected habitats.
Meanwhile, white storks are set to return to London after an absence of more than 600 years on a site earmarked at East Brookend Country Park in Dagenham. The project, spearheaded by funding from the Mayor of London and implemented by the London Wildlife Trust, aims to have storks on its site in autumn 2026, with beavers also being reintroduced to the area the following year.
And finally, the UK celebrated the milestone of 25 years of generating offshore wind power, which began with two turbines off the coast of Blyth in the year 2000. Now second only to China in capacity, which is good news. Offshore wind provides more than 17% of the UK's electricity needs, and each gigawatt of new offshore wind adds £2 to 3 billion of value to the UK economy.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Thank you. guessing how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Lovely track there by Bob Dylan, of course. Blowing in the wind from, can you believe, from 1963. Ouch. And on that note about clean power, because the article that's been in the press recently said the UK is second only to China in capacity, in its capacity for offshore wind provision, which is very interesting because a while back I saw a great article in another another piece of press that said 95% of the UK's energy will be from clean sources by 2030, which means from renewable sources, not from fossil fuels. So when we burn fossil fuels like coal and gas to generate electricity, this releases carbon dioxide, which contributes to global warming or climate change. But renewables such as the sun and wind are clean power. They don't produce carbon emissions like fossil fuels, and they're naturally replenished and never run out. All being well. The good news is that we are already leaders in the field of clean power. And as the recent article said, our offshore wind operation is second only to China. The grid was originally designed around coal, but connecting more renewable energy sources will allow Britain to fully reap the benefits that are offered by green energy. Expanding the grid itself will make this transition easier, faster, and increasingly efficient. So there's an expected 100% increase in Britain's electricity needs overall by 2050. So this is all about greater self-sufficiency. At the moment, Britain imports up to 41% of its energy to supply electricity. That's £112 billion in fossil fuels alone. But nearly half of our energy comes from more affordable renewables like wind and solar, and it could be much, much more. Mm. Our country has access to half of the offshore wind resource in Europe, and that's enough potential to more than cover even our greatest appetite for energy by 2050. By growing the grid, we can cut down on expensive imports and become truly self-sufficient in homegrown sources of clean power, boosting our long-term energy security at the same time. So that's all about the shift to clean power.
Sometimes I just can't take it. Can't take it, and it isn't alright. I'm not gonna make it. And I think my shoes untied. I'm like a broken record. I'm like a broken record, and I'm not playing right. Just gonna go out and kill me till you tell me on the heavenly phone. So hold tight. Just to let you know that you've got
missing in every second, dancing every hour. Oh yeah, you've got a higher power, and she really someone I wanna know. Electric, this boy is electric, and you're sparkling like the universe connected. And I'm buzzing night after night after night. This joy is electric, this joy is electric, and you're circuiting through. I'm so happy that I'm alive, happy I'm alive at the same time as you. Cause you've got a higher power, got me singing every second, dancing every hour.
Bit of Coldplay there, what's not to like, how higher power, yeah, talking like about that. The UK's clean power, being greatly more self-sufficient in terms of wind power, doing really well. If you just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. We're every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. Next up is a great article I saw. It questioned how to boost the taste of Riesling, which is a white wine, for those of you in the know. It's as simple as bark and white. And I thought, what's all that about? The article is being produced in Berlin, I think. So to bark, the conductor Leonard Bernstein said notes were not just sounds, but the very stuff of creation. And that observation may have been meant as a flight of fancy, but one winemaker in Germany has taken it literally and played Bach's Goldberg variations to a vat of Riesling wine in the hope it might improve the taste. For 10 months, the George Muller Foundation Vintner in Hattenheim, a few miles down from the River Rhine from Mainz, piped the 40-minute harpsichord composition into a 520-litre steel drum on a 24-hour loop. If you think that's all a bit bonkers, well, if you look at the scientific method, a second identical vat of the same vintage was left to mature in silence. So one was played music, and as a test against what difference it made, the other vat was left to mature on its own in silence. So the experiment was not quite as outlandish as it might sound. At least a dozen other vineyards around the world have tried the same thing. The Paradiso di Frassina estate in Tuscany bombards its vines with Mozart from loudspeakers, whereas Mont's wine in the Chilean Collega Valley has been filling its cellars with a recording of Gregorian chants by Irish monks for 2 decades. Now, the George Muller Foundation, this is in Germany, brought in Peter Keifer, who's a professor of contemporary music at the University of Mainz, who chose the Goldberg variations due to its intense vibrations. All interesting. So Tim Lillenstrom, who runs the winemaker's cellar, said the secondary fermentation had stopped earlier in the bark-saturated vat. The winery then invited Carsten Henn, a wine writer from Cologne, to conduct a blind tasting. Now, Carsten Henn significantly preferred the bark-infused Riesling. So he preferred the wine that came from a barrel or vat that had been played music to, describing it as fresher, purer, and more precise. So the guy running this experiment said he was pleased with the results, but they were not scientifically rigorous enough to amount to more than a poetic, artistic project. But it's a very interesting one. Maybe you'll hear that sort of thing going on around other parts of the world as well.
I hear the music on the side, yeah. I hear the music on my tight now, baby. I hear the music on my side. I hear the music, baby.
Belter of a track there by the Beach Boys, yes. No less. I can hear music. It was done in 1969. It was actually a Ronettes cover. Very interesting. We played that. I was talking about somebody experimenting with playing music to vats of wine to make it taste better, and it seems it did. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, a very interesting story about the papers that chart the mind of an early map maker. If you're a sailor in particular, you may have heard of Mercator projection, but it applies to the Atlas of the World or the Globe of the World. Very interesting. So long-lost 16th century manuscripts written by the cartographer Gerardus Mercator have been rediscovered. Conrad van Klimpel was sifting through leather-bound folders at the El Escorial Monastery near Madrid when he saw elegant cursive handwriting that he recognised. The professor from Hasselt University in Belgium said, "One of the librarian monks gave me a folder containing some mathematical manuscripts. I thought this could be really something." Now, Gerardus Mercator was born in 1512. That's a frightening little time ago. And he died in 1594, was one of the most important figures of the Renaissance. His terrestrial globe in 1541 was followed by his celestial globe in 1551 and a planispheric astrolabe right, which is shown. It's like a round disc, an astronomical instrument. His work coincided with exploration that increased demand for maps as tools of navigation. He's best known for the Mercator projection of the world as a flat map in 1569, and it's still the conventional projection of the Earth's shape on a flat surface. In recent times, that's been quite controversial, particularly I think Africa have objected to the fact that Mercator projection, to get it onto a flat piece of paper, you have to squash the world. So the bigger bits in the middle, like Africa, a shape smaller than they actually are. It's a very interesting one. You have a look at a world globe and then look at a flat piece of paper and map, but it's still groundbreaking stuff. And we, although we knew about Mercator projection, we couldn't quite believe it was done in 1569 and it still stands.
We thought it was 20th century.
Not quite, but Conrad van Klimpel said the manuscript lets us follow Mercator as he thinks, calculates and designs. That makes this manuscript priceless. The manuscript is now the subject of a PhD research project by Yves Vespri, a longtime river captain and pilot who has expertise in 16th century globe making and navigation. So there you go, Mercator projection. Well, you can't go wrong with a bit of Muse, can you? Map of the Problematique. And we played that because we're talking about Mercator Projection. Could you believe that that goes back to 1569? Of course, you listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. We're here every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. We shall have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning on this rather bright and sunny morning, for once.
Yeah, it makes a very pleasant change, isn't it?
It does indeed. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, a few things. A few things about our brains. One of the things which gave me a quick chuckle this morning was there's some new research which identifies that the human brain tends to light up when it hears chimp language. So
does
I thought
it?
That's pretty good. So I'm sure at the moment there's lots of brains lighting up.
I wonder if that's why the PG Tips use them. I think it was PG Tips for their tea adverts.
I think we've got a great affinity with our potential forebears or cousins, probably. Oh. But I thought that was that's pretty good. And there's quite a lot around at the moment on our brains. But one of the other things, because it's that kind of season approaching fast, I came across something which hadn't really sort of landed with me until I sort of read an article, which is the appearance in Star Trek of an alternative to alcohol. And if you're not a great Trekkie, then in Star Trek The New Generation, they started to use what they called synthahol, which was a synthetic form of alcohol. But it was formulated so that Star Trek officers could drink and get some of the buzz and some of the benefits of alcohol, but without the nasty hangover and other issues that occur with it. Mm-hmm. So, like a lot of things in scientific sort of developments, it appears in Star Trek. And Gene Roddenberry has sort of had a very kind of moral code running in the background. And he was a smoker, and yet he actually banned Star Trek officers from using tobacco. Synthahol, and I thought, well, that's sounds like a kind of good idea, and I sort of did dig around and found an article in a thing that I get a newsletter from, which talked about a professor who has actually developed a synthetic alcohol. And I thought, totally new to me. I mean, I'm old school, a user of alcohol in various forms. So I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And then I thought, hang on a minute, I've got this right, because the credit was for Professor David Nutt. I thought, is this kind of or not? But I did a bit of digging around, and Professor Nutt was actually a scientific advisor to UK government. And I think it's something like 2009, he resigned after the team that he was working among published a risk table for various sort of drugs. And at number five, they proudly placed alcohol as being one of the most dangerous drugs. And it was factored around the number of deaths caused or related to the particular drugs. So his sort of synthesized alcohol has really sort of started to take off, and he'd sort of gone down this road to now actually create this alternative to alcohol. So he's world renowned, and he sort of did an interview which was published in the Drinks Trust, and he talks about changing from his advisory role to creating alternatives to alcohol. So he said that he resigned in 2009, and at GABA Lab, which is said his new sort of place of work, we aren't against alcohol, he said, but can understand its appeal and the role it's played in society for centuries. So human beings are social, and alcohol seems to support connecting, relaxing, and bringing people together. That, however, if we maintain that, if it gets overused, alcohol becomes a very dangerous substance. Mm-hmm. And during the pandemic, for example, there were 8,974 deaths from alcohol-specific causes registered in the UK, which was nearly 19% increase compared to the previous year. And every family in Britain has probably been damaged to some extent by alcohol. So it's what he says is basically ethanol, which is the base of alcohol, is old technology. And he felt that the government was falling short in taking a proactive line to give viable alternatives. And I mean, I think if you wandered around in our own city centre, you can see quite a few instances of people who are worse for wear with alcohol, amongst other things. So he sort of took that and decided to make a drink rather than fight to change things with the government. So he's developed this new line of drinks that can give you the kind of taste, the flavours, and some of the buzz of alcohol. And he called it Sentia, which is his alternative to alcohol. And the news that an approval process for this would be long and fairly expensive, so they wanted to demonstrate the proof of concept quickly, so that they could get investors, but also to get the general public interested. So I remember sort of looking around at 0% alcohol, which was promoters for people who didn't want to get the worst effects of alcohol. But you didn't always get the better effects. And I think your piece on wine making...
Yeah, play some music to it.
you've got to be kind of creative, but... Over the years, alcohol's developed. We talked about the growth of the use of beer around the world, and that was really as an alternative to poor quality water.
Yeah, indeed.
Available.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing to say. Well, here we are getting to the science. But in a nutshell, he says the GABA aminobutyric acid, which is GABA, which is his new thing, is naturally occurring substance that acts as a neurotransmitter, so it gets to your brain and nervous system, and it produces, he says, a calming effect where people feel sociable and reduces your feelings of anxiety, stress, and fear. And it says it works naturally by replicating the feeling of drinking alcohol, triggering the brain's natural responses, and it's those neurotransmitters that are responsible for the sensations of sociability. So, like a lot of people, they feel more relaxed after they've had a drink or two, and they think that that helps things to move along a little bit more sort of smoothly. And the balance has always been getting to a nice state like that and not going over the edge into the state where you start to lose control and lots of other things that can occur. So he says this GABA has been around for billions of years. Your body produces it naturally all the time, modulating your levels of relaxation and harmony. And he says consuming high volumes of alcohol leads to all sorts of unpleasant effects, but more moderate volumes, around one or two units, raise your body's GABA activity. So it's really sort of trying to get to the same roots and create this new drink called Sentia.
Wow. And,
on Star Trek, I think the engineer was having a drink with the android robot and said of this new drink, this synthahol, it's very green, isn't it?
So is it in production, Paul?
It is, yeah.
Wow, you know, isn't that an interesting one?
Yeah, you it's, know. Like I say, it came sort of to me out of left field. I just thought, oh, it's great. You know, we talk quite often about science appearing in science fiction and how sometimes that's got reality to it. And that was really what prompted me to go and have a look at this sort of phenomena and to sort of question, well, it's been around since at least 2009 as a premise.
Wow.
And,
yeah.
And we're not really seeing a big push to it where it is truly a terrible sort of effect upon humanity. You know, we've got lots of problems with alcohol addiction in various places in the country. It's probably becoming the highest factor in deaths. And so we're sort of starting out from chasing this pleasurable part of it where it sort of breaks down our inhibitions and makes us more sociable. So I think they call one of the drinks Club Soda, so that got a role in promoting mindful drinking community.
Amazing. Well, you know, it's interesting because if you think about it, alcohol goes back many, many years. The Romans were drinking wine and people were brewing beer and things because it's coming from a natural source, isn't it? Alcohol generally comes from a natural...
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the basic alcohol comes from natural yeast collecting from the air, and it's a bit like sourdough bread. Sourdough, instead of using a manufactured yeast, starts with a natural yeast and feeds it and grows it to become a mother yeast.
Yeah.
And it's the same with some alcohol. I used to work in a brewery, so one of the jobs I used to get was extracting the yeast from beer after it had been through the brewing and fermenting process. And that often went off. A lot of people would take that yeast as a sort of health promoting thing.
Interesting. And of course, it's often sugar as well, isn't it? You know, it needs sugar. Yeah. Yeast generally needs sugar to activate it, I think.
Well, that's it. Sugar feeds the yeast while it's developing and it grows. So basically, when you put in a bucket full of yeast to start a brew in a massive vat, you'll get several times that back when the final beer has brewed and reached the alcohol levels that you want it to achieve. It's then sort of extracted by filtration. And you find it in things like Vegemite and a lot of those kind of things. And yeast tablets are quite a thing. And it used to be promoted for skin conditions, so you could use it. But I think if this is a real product that's available, and sometimes I think as scientists you have to be aware of Well, it sounds like a great idea, looks like a great idea, but the proof is in application. So, as I just say, for me, it started as just reading a byline about this new synthetic alcohol, and sort of following that to see the thing of Star Trek: The New Generation.
Synthahol.
It just seems really sort of an interesting track, but I think down the road of sort of problems that we have, sort of mental problems and issues that we get, another article I read in the iPaper was from Claire Wilson, and she was talking about how depression, anxiety and PTSD could all be part of the same brain disorder. So says that they're quite often seen as three separate mental health conditions, but they could really be different aspects of an underlying brain disorder. And in fact, she says that the 14 most common mental health and neurodiversity conditions seem to be around five clusters of closely working, closely related disorders. So they were sort of looking at neurodiversity and suggested that there may be ways to define and treat mental health, but the ones that we're currently using may be flawed. So they explained that many people are diagnosed with more than one condition because they have the same genetic root cause. So it's bringing in the realm of autism and ADHD within that umbrella, and saying that most psychiatrists would acknowledge that at diagnosis and treatment of these varied conditions are at a far earlier stage than most physical health problems, and it's on a much less scientific footing. So we still don't know the underlying biological causes of the most common conditions like depression, anxiety, anorexia and schizophrenia. So with mental health problems, no blood tests or scans to confirm a diagnosis. So we're very much sort of looking at a human interpretation of those things, and researchers are now seeking a better understanding of what the root cause of mental health could be. So there's work done by an enormous international group of scientists who shared the genetic sequences of more than a million people with 14 mental health or neurodiversity conditions, as well as 5 million unaffected people who were used for comparison. And they confirmed previous findings that the conditions were found to have a strong genetic influence involving 238 common genetic variants. And some of the genes shared by the 14 conditions gave partial support for a radical theory that proposes all mental health conditions have a common underlying biological root.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, so that's some of the sort of trigger conditions, I think, that a lot of people are worried about. And there's a lot of sort of looking back at the recent sort of COVID pandemic, or the current COVID pandemic, if if you look at it.
Well, COVID is flu, isn't it? It's a type of flu, basically.
Yeah. So sort of looking at that and looking at the apparent sort of mental illness that people have. Some of the things that they're worried about, why people don't want to go back to work, and looking for some root causes. So it looks like that that line of research is something that hopefully could give us a bit of a route map to dealing with those issues. And again, it's something that's come out of genetic analysis. So that's an interesting article. And again, one of the problems I think that have been highlighted for people quite often coming from COVID is a problem with sleeping. And some other analysis has been done into using blue light and how it could actually help. And again, it's another article from Claire Wilson, and it says that if you have a bright dose of blue light in the morning, you can have a better sleep later on in the night. And it says that if the participants had about 2 hours of blue light in the morning, they reported that they had a much less disturbed sleep. So I think a lot of the time the light effects gets sort of conflated into the problem with people using computer screens, and the coloration factor from a computer screen. So confusingly, that used to be identified a lot as blue light coming from your computer screen. And I think this new research needs to be sort of funneled into a better regime, because if you come across the condition called SAD disorder, which is the kind of light conditions we're now entering into, where it's dark and dismal through a lot of your day, and it can help to give you a feeling of depression and not feeling mentally very, very well. And the application of light for that is to have an alarm clock that awakens you with a daylight quality light emitted from it. And that's one of the things to sort of get you out of bed in the morning, because the other side effect of this is that you don't really want to get up.
I can agree with that, Paul. But you know, this article where Claire was just saying, if you see that blue light in the morning, you're likely to sleep better in the evening. That's all to do with regulating your circadian rhythm, isn't it? Because in winter, it's very difficult when it's dark in the morning. You're not being triggered to be awakened.
But again, she talks about the general conditions as well. So we're talking about having your bedrooms at a relatively cool temperature, about 18 degrees centigrade, and doing things like having a bath and timing when you do different things. So I think a lot of it is in line with circadian rhythm. So it's about when you eat. Should you eat before you go to bed? And I know clickbait now is going through lots of things about why you should always eat a banana before you go to bed, and you know, whatever the latest splurge is to get people to go down a particular route. So
I think the key is, I think general research says stick to a routine, you know, try and keep you when you go to bed and when you get up the same no matter what day it is, which can be hard, can't it?
Well, I think it is, but I think, again, it's one of the things, what's the circadian rhythm? I mean, we tend to become creatures of habit. And sometimes if we develop a habit over a lifetime and it's not a good habit, it's really difficult to break out of it.
It is. I mean, somebody who lives across from us, Andy, he used to work on the buses as a manager, and used to get up. He used to be at work at 4 every morning. I mean, he's been retired the best part of probably 30 years, and he still gets up at that time, because his body's almost conditioned to do it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I said sometimes you've got to go back to sort of basics, and I think other times we look at new research, and sometimes it's a rediscovery of things, isn't it?
It is. But on that note, Paul, we'll have to let you go, because we've got a great track for you, as you know, Right On by Santana, and the film show are ready and waiting to come in.
Thank you, Paul.
Great stuff, Paul. Sleep well. Have a nice glass of wine later on, with or without alcohol. But I was going to say, some of the non-alcoholic drinks have got a lot of sugar in them, which is as it finishes. But anyway, and we'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
I look forward to
bye-bye,
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
of us were born with races to win. Some of us are aware. Feel the icy wind through the poverty, no.